Our good friends from university days, Brian and Jennifer Moran, are spending up to a year in Mukinji, Zambia as short-term missionaries. They have good jobs in the Orillia area. Brian is a teacher, and Jennifer is employed at the municipal library. Their three daughters are now grown and out on their own. Somehow Jennifer and Brian sensed the Lord leading them to give a year, in Brian's case, a half year for Jennifer to work in Africa. Jennifer's latest blog describes Brian's current activity and it exemplifies in some ways the ethos or the attitude that Paul encourages the church to develop in his letter to Timothy. Jennifer writes, "The head teacher at the Mukinji Hill Academy has returned to England on furlough, so Brian has taken over the responsibilities of head teacher while continuing to teach the grade 6 class. Just to keep him out of trouble, he stays after school to try and finish putting up the ceiling boards in his classroom." This is his classroom in the bottom right, so he's working away on construction there. "Add to this his computer class at the nursing school that he holds Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday evening, and he is quite busy. Computer classes should be finished by the time I return to Canada in April, so that'll give him a little more time to concentrate on his other duties. So prayer for wisdom, energy, strength, and patience would all be appreciated." Busy man. A key word in that first line sums up the focus of his activity: responsibilities. In our affluent Western culture, the temptation is to shirk responsibility and become a busy buddy instead of fruitfully busy about the right things. Yeah. Continuous effort, even for good works, can be draining. How do we keep restored and recharged? Paul offers us a clue about that, too. Before we start immersing ourselves in the Apostles' guidance to the early church, let's acknowledge there's a huge gap between our cultural reality and the situation back then. We live very much in a welfare state, not so much as Britain perhaps, but more so than the U.S. We don't have to mortgage the house in order to have an operation. We pay considerable taxes in order to enjoy universal health coverage. For those who can't find work, there's social assistance and employment insurance. If our house catches on fire or a relative falls unconscious, we can call 911 and know someone at the other end is going to respond. What if you didn't have all that? What if you lived back in the first century where there was no health coverage, hardly any medical care, no old age pension, and no social safety net? Who's going to pick up the slack? The state's role was much smaller. Enforcing law and order, facilitating transportation through improved roads, much of ordinary life was left up to the citizens. What other social institutions were there? Of course, there was the family. People depended a lot more on their relatives. Also, there was this brand new social phenomenon called the Christian Church. Something that made the church very noticeable was the way it stepped into the gap where family provision stopped and the state hadn't yet begun. 1 Timothy 5:16. If any woman who is a believer has widows in her family, she should help them and not let the church be burdened with them, so that the church can help those widows who are really in need. You can see the division of labor there. Families are to help their own relatives who have fallen on hard times. The church had already accepted some responsibility to help those who were really in need, who had no family to take care of them. It sensed God's nudge, God's leading to be burdened with or accept the weight of caring for those who had no one else to provide for them. This really caught the attention of those outside the church. The danger in a welfare state is that an attitude of entitlement can develop. We sort of start expecting everything is going to be done for us. We have it coming to us. This may be partly a contrast as well between the World War II GI generation and the more spoiled boomers, my generation, that followed. GI gents had to be entrepreneurial, starting businesses and enterprises. Many young people today go to college expecting that when they graduate, some already established company will provide a ready-made job for them. That model is getting challenged by our current economy. Families, Paul's saying, should take initiative to help their own relatives, easing the burden on the church so it can take initiative to help those who are most desperate. become generous and entrepreneurial rather than stymied in entitlement. So for many centuries, until the rise of the welfare state, the church played an important role as a vehicle providing care to the poorest in society. This arises from a non-entitlement attitude. To quote John F. Kennedy's 1961 inaugural address, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Another danger we face from the university student on reading week retirees soaking up sun in their southern timeshare is the inclination to party hardy. Verse 15, Paul warns that some have in fact already turned away to follow Satan. Can't be good. What's he mean? Probably not talking about Satan worship, but something more subtle. That Christians were getting tempted by evil desires and pastimes. Verse 6, but the widow who lives for pleasure is dead even while she lives. Ooh, that's harsh. The person who lives for pleasure, wouldn't that describe much of our culture? Living for pleasure? Living for the weekend? Stashing cash in our RRSP so we can take it easy and relax at the end of our work life? Is it March 3rd this year is the deadline? The person who lives for pleasure is dead even while they live. The walking dead, if you will. Nobody home. From an eternal perspective, you've checked out from Christ's kingdom if you're only pursuing pleasure. Verse 11, Paul cautions that sensual desires can overcome one's dedication to Christ. In RSV, sensual desires alienate them from Christ. Fleshly appetites unchecked can sabotage our spiritual life in Jesus. Verse 13, also as a warning pertinent to our time. It says, besides they get into the habit of being idle and going about from house to house, not only do they become idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things they ought not to. Being idle, as in the expression couch potato, watching the Olympics can turn into a very unhealthy lifestyle, kind of the opposite of the sporting approach. Wandering around the houses. When Friday comes, some folks are all keen to find out where the closest party is happening. And idling can lead to creativity of dialogue, making up things to talk about, perhaps at others' expense. Not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things they ought not to. Say, did you hear about so-and-so? And thus begins a little bit of character assassination. The Greek word for busybodies is defined in the lexicon as busy about trifles and neglectful of important matters. Busy about trifles and neglectful of important matters. Backwards priorities, majoring the minors. Busy, yes, but busy about trifles, things of no consequence, while neglectful of or ignoring important matters. Maybe you're not a party animal. I look at you this morning and I don't think you're really that much party animals, but do you find your priorities tend to get turned around? When you look back at your day, have you really accomplished what was needed? Or did pleasurable sidelines creep in? How many of us streamed an Olympic hockey game at our workplace this past week? Some will say that was our patriotic duty. How many sick days are lost to employers because their workers were hung over from the weekend? How hard is it to give up that hour on a weeknight watching our favorite show in order to volunteer with that charitable group or community organization? Living for pleasure, our desires twist what ought to be our priorities askew. Now, there have been quite a few popular movies and TV series based on the Victorian period in England. For example, Pride and Prejudice, which I know the guys won't be familiar with. Other Jane Austen stories, North and South, Downton Abbey, and so on. If you have watched any of those, have you noticed in some of those how little the upper class gentry are actually seeming to accomplish? Much of their time is spent idling. Sitting around, dancing, playing cards, shooting pheasants, hunting for a fox. Even when they go on a picnic, it's their servants, the working class, who have to lug the basket and paraphernalia up the hill. Sometimes their whole existence, based largely on living for pleasure and amusements, seems so empty. Are we that much different? Respect is in many ways the foundation of ethics. The Mexican proverb says, respect the rights of others and you will have peace. Irish radio broadcaster Frankie Byrne said, respect is love in plain clothes. Respect is love in plain clothes. So in Paul's advice to his young protege Timothy on how to treat others in the church, respect figures prominently. Verses 1 and 2. Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. Now, Timothy's appointment amounted to the equivalent of a bishop, overseer of the local elders, yet Paul instructed him not to play the heavier pull rank by harshly rebuking the older men of the congregation, which he might have, but instead exhort them. Now, the Greek term is related to what Jesus used for the Holy Spirit, paraclete, comfort, counsel, encourage. Be considerate towards all those in the church, just as you would your own family, as mothers, sisters, brothers. Verse 3 continues, give proper recognition, or NRSV, honor, to those widows who are really in need. Respect should be the keynote in all our dealings, not throwing our weight around, bullying, or pressuring to get our way. The Apostle Peter told church leaders in 1 Peter 5:3, not to be lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. The theme that comes through most strongly in this passage is that of responsibility. The church overall, as we noted, is to take responsibility, be burdened for widows and others who are truly in need, with no one else to help them. Those in families are to look after their own relatives. Verse 8. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Wow. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's a pretty powerful statement. Why even worse than an unbeliever? When we profess faith in God, we sign on to pledges such as the Ten Commandments, which includes honor your who? Father and mother. When we fail to do that, it's worse than for unbelievers who never promised to take on such obligations in the first place. Let's insert here for dads that providing for your relatives includes but isn't limited to material provision, bringing home the bacon. That's important, but your wife and children also look to you to provide physical and emotional affection, attention, time, and meaningful interaction, loving with your heart and soul as well as your strength. I don't know if it was announced last week, but we did get in the Promise Keepers devotionals for Valentine's Day for couples. That's another important way you can provide for your families, providing spiritual leadership. Take those books home. Use them to provide spiritual input to your family. Several other verses reflect this need to show responsibility. Verse 4. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn first of all to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. Your parents brought you into this world, nourished you, clothed you, spent hours awake at night for you, took you to the hospital, and doctors, and dentists, maybe paid thousands of dollars to your orthodontist in some cases, took you to sports practices and games, and spent countless hours in cold arenas to cheer you on, prayed for you, and tore their hair out over you during your teen years, probably, agonized with you over your relational breakups, and helped you get lunch into a family of your own. Their lives have been invested sacrificially in you. To quote our daughter Emily, that graphic in the bulletin, a mother's sacrifice is her child's reward. We owe care to our older family members. God's pleased with that. Verse 14, Paul counsels younger widows to marry, to have children, to manage their homes, and to give the enemy no opportunity for slander. That again involves responsibility. Verse 16, women who have widows in their family should help them and not let the church be burdened with them. Accept responsibility for your relatives who are in need. Yes, Cain, you are your brother's keeper, your mother's, your aunt's, and so on. Verses 9 and 10 seem to point to a special order or group created in the church to superintend the needs of poor widows. Verse 9, no widow may be put on the list of widows unless she is over 60. Now, the word list here is like catalog or roll or registry, perhaps of ecclesiastical order of single senior female presbyters, elders like Dorcas in Acts 9:41, different from deaconesses because that could include younger unmarried women. One commentary notes, Tertullian, Hermas, and Chrysostom mention such an order of ecclesiastical widowhood, each one not less than 60 years old, and resembling the presbyters in the respect paid to them and in some of their duties. They ministered with sympathizing counsel to other widows and to orphans, a ministry to which their own experimental knowledge of the feelings and sufferings of the bereaved adapted them, and had a general supervision of their sex. So, man, that's something the modern church hasn't really carried forward from the early church, is this ecclesiastical order of widowhood. In the description of requirements we see, similar to the description for elders and deacons back in chapter 3 for men, qualities that would show maturity of character for any Christian woman. Responsibility runs through all of these, verses 9 and 10. No widow may be put on the list of widows unless she's over 60, has been faithful to her husband, is well known for her good deeds, such as bringing up children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the saints, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. The words showing hospitality are more literally welcoming strangers. Washing the feet of the saints recalls Jesus' action in John 13, symbolically washing the disciples' dirty feet, adopting a servant attitude that asks, how can I help you? Paraphrase JFK, ask not what they can do for you, but what you can do for them. Respect, responsibility. It is possible to become so weighed down with responsibility that life isn't much fun anymore. Perhaps those who are middle-aged are most susceptible to this, what we call the sandwich generation, sandwiched between the needs of your offspring and grandchildren, perhaps, while also dealing with aging parents, whether in their own or seniors' homes. How do we cope when others' needs press in and rob us of personal free time? How can we get restored and replenished when life becomes a grind, when our responsibilities seem overwhelming? Paul gives us a clue if you look closely at verse 5. He says, the widow who is really in need and left all alone puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. Jesus promised he would send the Holy Spirit to dwell inside us, to be a paraclete, one who comes alongside to help. How did Jesus himself get restored at a very draining time in his ministry? Mark 1:35 tells us that very early in the morning, after a night when the whole town gathered at the door to be healed, it says Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. We need God's refreshing. We need to make time for that replenishing, refilling. The Apostle Paul himself deal with the pressures of responsibility. For example, 2 Corinthians 11:28, he says, besides everything else, I face the daily pressure of my concern for all the churches. A few verses later, he recalls Jesus' own promise to him. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, Paul says, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. Jesus knows your pressures, your burdens, what the kingdom is calling for from you. Let his power renew and refresh you. Craig McCartney of Christian Week tells of a film being released about Heidi Baker, the nickname of the Mother Teresa of Africa, who's been caring for the poor and the orphans of Mozambique with her husband Roland for almost 20 years. The article says, the Bakers have seen dramatic transformation in Mozambique. When they first arrived, it was the world's poorest country. Their ministry, Iris Global, now cares for more than 10,000 children daily and has planted more than 10,000 churches. That's a huge responsibility. What fuels this couple to accomplish such amazing ministry to so many? Is there some secret? The article continues. Baker says Westerners often complicate the gospel, which keeps them from sharing God's love. She believes reaching out begins with the greatest commandment, falling in love with Jesus. As you allow His love to pour into you, she says, it's easier to let His love move you to stop for the one in front of you. You can't care for them all. It's not about the multitudes. The Bible just says, love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's that easy. It's letting God love you and loving the one in front of you, stopping for the one every day. In Western society, Baker says, loving your neighbor means giving your time and building relationships. But she cautions not to leave out the first commandment, loving God. Says, in North America, being compelled by love is first being present with God and spending time in His presence. You have to give the thing most valuable, which in North America is your time. Give your time in adoration and in the Word, and then stop for the one. It's just stopping, loving, and letting Jesus shine through your